playing the numbers game on Syria's chemical weapons. Today, Wednesday, January 8th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The first batch of chemical weapons materials has left Syria, but it's only a small portion of Assad's total stockpile.
Such a small amount will be seen by many as largely symbolic and not a reflection of a process that is going to end anytime soon.
Also, one of Sudan's lost boys on why he decided to go back.
Home is home, you know? That's why I was so excited to go back just to see the River Nile, how beautiful that country is.
Plus, a beer-drinking German on a trip to Scotland gets some life-changing advice from a local.
You have to drink single malt whiskey, because that's what Scotland is all about.
Can't argue with that. It's all coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Finally, the removal of chemical weapons materials from Syria has begun. The first batch of chemicals left the Syrian port of Latakia on board a Danish ship yesterday. But that was just the start of the mission, which is being run jointly by the UN and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW. The BBC's Anna Holligan is monitoring from Cyprus.
This is a numbers game, and we have had the confirmation from the OPCW and the UN that the first consignment of these chemical agents have been removed from Syrian territory. And they are celebrating this as encouraging news, but urging the Syrian government to continue the momentum. But if we look at the numbers, this is what is significant. So we understand it through a source close to the operation to be 16 tons. And that's out of 630 tons, which were meant to be removed from Syria by the 31st of December. So we're talking about a really small amount. And unless more of these containers start arriving at the port of Latakia to be taken away for destruction in the coming days or possibly weeks, then such a small amount, so few containers, 9 containers we're talking about here, will be seen by many as largely symbolic and not a reflection of a process that is going to end anytime soon.
So why is this operation behind schedule?
It's been fraught with difficulties since the start of this most complicated part of the whole plan. So the easy part, as it were, was getting President Assad to sign up to the Chemical Weapons Convention. The problems that they're encountering now is transporting the containers to the port in Latakia. It's the first time the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has ever tried to do anything like this inside a country that's still engaged in a civil conflict. So there have been problems, inherent problems that you might expect with such operation. The OPCW talked about constantly changing front lines. And there have even been things like bureaucracy, getting the international equipment to the places it was meant to be in time. And even the weather, bad weather, has forced some of the roads in the area to close.
I mean, it's just kind of shocking to hear you say the easy part was getting Assad to sign the Chemical Weapons Convention. Mm. Now 614 tons of chemical weapons to go. So this is the first shipment. Now what happens to this stuff?
Well, this first shipment was put on board the Danish cargo vessel taken out of Syrian territorial waters. So that cargo vessel is now in international waters waiting for more containers to arrive at the port. And when it eventually, if it eventually happens that the 630 tons of mustard gas and the precursors or ingredients for sarin and VX nerve agents are delivered to the cargo vessels, they will then transport these chemicals to a port in Italy, which hasn't been publicly named. And there they will be transloaded to the US naval vessel, the Cape Ray. And on board the Cape Ray, they've created this specially modified titanium tank where the neutralization process will take place.
What is the mood like on the ship where the troops are that are tasked with dismantling these chemical weapons?
We spent more than a week living on board the Norwegian warship, so we got to know the mood and we witnessed their training sessions. So every day was a kind of process of preparation. Although they weren't going into this as a combat operation going into Syria, they were there to provide a protective presence. they were aware of the potential danger involved. So they would say, we expect nothing, but we're prepared for everything.
The BBC's Anna Holligan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Covering the story in Syria is not easy for journalists. More than 60 have been killed since the conflict began almost 3 years ago. We're going to spend a couple of minutes now finding out about just one of them. Yasser Faisal al-Jumaili was killed sometime around December 4th in Idlib in Syria. Jane Araf knew Yasser well. Jane reports for Al Jazeera English and the Christian Science Monitor out of Baghdad. She's currently in Washington, though. Who was Yasser Faisal al-Jumaili, Jane? What was he like?
Yasser was very, very Iraqi, and by that I mean he was extraordinary, very often inexplicable, a little bit mysterious, and amazingly, amazingly talented and brave. We have to say that about him. I worked with Yasser for several years, and most recently, just a couple of weeks before he died, on assignment for Al Jazeera America in the south of Iraq. He had gone to Syria to do stories because I think part of the reason he went really is that people didn't care about Iraq anymore. And he was an amazingly talented cameraman, a driven journalist, and he had a family to support. He was a freelancer, and that's why he went.
Now, he was from Fallujah in Iraq. He knew what war was about. He knew what he was doing, right?
He absolutely knew what he was doing, more than most people. We have to remember that Fallujah, again in the news, was one of the most violent places in Iraq, a place you had to navigate very, very carefully. And Yasser managed to operate in the middle of all that, balancing all of those different players. You could get anything you needed, anything you wanted, if Yasser was there. I mean, there were times when he would say, I can't do that, it's too dangerous. But if he could, he would find a way to get in, to find those people you were looking for, the women who had been imprisoned, the children who had been in jail, the former al-Qaeda fighters, and put you in touch with them and do it in a way that brought those stories to life to the rest of the world. Yasser's work was the reason that a lot of viewers saw anything at all from Fallujah and Ramadi when it was far too dangerous for foreigners to go in. Yasser was the one. People like Yasser were the people who were getting those images out.
There was one line that you wrote, Jane, in your online remembrance of Yasser that really struck me. You said, for a macho guy from Fallujah, he was always eager to offer wonderfully specific opinions about colors and makeup. I mean, so he was not just an artist, but one who was in a place that offered a very nuanced sense of beauty.
He did. He was kind of a fashionista, actually. He dressed very well. And it was that wonderful quality in a cameraman where, particularly out in the field, where you're not always, you're not always dressed as well as you should be if you're doing a piece to camera. But he was absolutely meticulous, and he had an eye for beauty, whether it was colors that would pop on the screen or whether it was a reflected image that he was filming. He was gifted, and he had a wonderful sense of beauty and a sense of whimsy as well.
So what happened to Yasser in Syria, and do we know who is to blame or why he was killed?
He's believed to have been executed, and executed is the right word, by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which is essentially an incarnation of al-Qaeda. Yasser didn't really tell anybody when he was going to Syria. He didn't tell his family. He didn't tell his friends. He showed up in Syria. He appeared to have been contracted by a Spanish production company that he had done work for before. They had asked him to do work in Iraq in places that I thought were really dangerous, and I had told him that perhaps he shouldn't be doing work for people who weren't sending somebody with him, because as a television journalist, when I do television work, I would never ask a cameraman to do something that I wouldn't do myself. It's a very complicated equation, but Syria was sort of like that. He was, again, a freelancer, so he was in the position of being the guy who would go into places that were too dangerous for most people and send back the footage so it could be put together in some other country.
Jane, aside from friends and colleagues like you, who did Yasser leave behind, like family? Tell me a bit about them.
Well, he was married and he had three small children. The eldest is 10, a 10-year-old girl, and the youngest is a year and a half. And They are understandably absolutely devastated, as is the rest of his family. Yasser was very, very special. I know we say that about a lot of people, but I so wish the people who saw his images could have known him. We went on a lot of trips together to places where you had to be very, very careful. And in all of those places where you had to watch every single step, he still managed to get the most beautiful, beautiful footage, because he was also an artist. He was a journalist and an artist. His family, obviously, that's all an unimaginable loss, particularly since they are still in Fallujah, a city which is probably about to be attacked for the third time to release it from the grip of Al-Qaeda and other groups. But Yasser was almost irreplaceable. And I think that is one of the things that we need to remember when we look at the videos on YouTube or the constant images that we see. We tend to forget that there is a person behind that lens. And very often it was a wonderful person, a brave person like Yasser.
Reporter Jane Aarav, we're very sorry for your loss, but thanks so much for telling us about Yasser.
Thank you so much.
The group believed to be responsible for the death of journalist Yasser Faisal al-Jumaili in Syria is the same group that seized Fallujah in Iraq last week. As Jane mentioned, it's an al-Qaeda-linked group called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. Confusingly, this group is also sometimes referred to as the ISIL. It's all to do with the historic name of the region they're fighting for. So for today's The World That Was, our resident history buff Chris Wolf is here to explain. So what is correct, Chris? What do they call themselves?
In Arabic, it's al-Dawla al-Islamiyya fi al-Iraq wa al-Sham, which literally means the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham. And Sham being the historic Arabic name for what you might call Greater Syria, or what sometimes you call in the West the Levant, which is where the L comes from.
Right. And Levant is a French word?
It is. It literally means the rising, and it's to do with the sun. If you're in the Western Mediterranean, France, you look east, the sun starts rising in the east. It's still in use, but it's a kind of semi-archaic term in English and French for the region of the Eastern Mediterranean.
So be a little more precise. Where exactly are we talking about?
Well, there is a debate about that. Most modern scholars, when they say Levant, they're talking about the area of the Eastern Mediterranean coast from southernmost Turkey down through Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, down to the Egyptian border. Some people would throw in Cyprus as well. Historically, it could mean a slightly bigger region. In Queen Elizabeth's time in England in the 1500s, a company of merchant adventurers trading to the Levant was set up, and their monopoly of trade was everything east of Italy. So back then, it meant kind of the Eastern Mediterranean in a broader sense. And then you can also talk about the Far East. In historical terms, you'll see in documents, they'll talk about the Upper Levant, meaning China.
So the members of the ISIS or the ISIL, what do they prefer to use?
They say ISIS, and they literally mean from the Quranic name, Sham. Now, the origin of Sham is something interesting as well, because even today, a lot of people in the Middle East can't agree on where it comes from. A lot of people think it comes from the Arabic word for the sun, Shams, which would fit in with the Levant thing and the rising of the sun. But scholars say that actually it's more Quranic. If you're in Mecca and you're looking east, the Bilad al-Sham is the land to your left, on your left hand, and the Bilad al-Yemin, Yemen, is the land on your right. But again, there are sun-based names in Arabic as well. Maghreb, which is the word for North Africa, literally means the land of the setting sun. And on a final note, after all this talk about rising suns and mornings for Westerners, in Iran, the Persian historic name for Syria is Shom, which also means dinner.
Always learn something new here, Chris. The World That Was with our history guy, Chris Wolf. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Still ahead, a Sudanese lost boy returns home only to find himself in the middle of battle again on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The trial of Egypt's deposed president, Mohamed Morsi, was postponed today until next month. Morsi is charged with inciting the murder of demonstrators back in 2012. The military-backed government has cracked down hard on Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood since his overthrow. It's arrested almost the entire Brotherhood leadership and thousands of its backers as well. But it's not just the Islamists the government is trying to control. It's all aspects of religion in Egypt, as Kimberly Adams reports from Cairo.
In Cairo's winding side streets, you'll find carts pulled by horses or motorcycles loaded with produce. On every other street they pass, there is a place for the men to stop and pray. It's called a zawiya, a kind of mini mosque. They're located in basements and storefronts across Egypt. Mosque caretaker Fauzi Mohammed leads the afternoon prayers at the tiny Faith Mosque in the district of Manyo. A few months ago, the Minister of Religious Affairs banned Friday sermons at many small mosques like Mohammed's. The minister also revoked the licenses of tens of thousands of imams preaching at some local zawiyas, claiming at least some of them were promoting terrorism.
Of course we are very sad because there were other people here with us, good people, who came to pray the Friday prayer here with us.
The government pays the salaries of most of the country's imams, and it's trying to control the messages from the mosques by requiring that all imams are graduates of Al-Azhar University.
Al-Azhar is a mosque and a school that was built to teach Islamic theology, Sharia.
Ahmed Morsi is a research associate based in Cairo for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says the thousand-year-old religious institution is also a key player in Egyptian politics.
Because the Egyptian government, since Nasser until Mubarak, and I would argue even until now, they believe that they need Al-Azhar at every single step. Al-Azhar represents a very important institution that can give legitimacy to the ruler, regardless of what the ruler is doing.
Or take that legitimacy away. When Egypt's military last summer pushed out President Mohamed Morsi in response to huge protests against the Islamist leader, Al-Azhar stood with the military, not the president. Just after the top general read out the decision on state TV, the Sheikh of Al-Azhar, Ahmed Al-Tayeb, voiced his support.
I agree with the army's decision, supported by the people, to oust President Morsi. I pray to God Almighty that the two opposing parties will come together as one and drink from the same Nile.
Morsi supporters were livid. During the 2011 revolution, Al-Azhar said protests to oust Hosni Mubarak were un-Islamic. So how could the institution support the protest to remove Morsi? Shortly after the military takeover last summer, popular television preacher Safwat Hegazi railed against Al-Azhar's grand imam in front of a massive pro-Morsi sit-in in Cairo. Now you are saying that protesting to overturn a president who is legitimately elected is permissible? Hegazi decried. As the crowd roared its agreement, Hegazi shouted that the Grand Imam's decision was invalid and should not represent the institution of Al-Azhar. Later, hundreds were killed as the military cleared that sit-in. Hegazi and other pro-Morsi preachers like him were among thousands arrested. Protests have since retreated to universities, including the campus of Al-Azhar itself. Al-Azhar is legally independent from the government, but its funding is controlled by the Ministry of Religious Affairs, and the religion ministry's ranks are filled with Al-Azhar grads. Unlike Western separation of state and religion, many Egyptians expect that the government should play a role in religious life.
Because Islam and politics has been intertwined through the centuries, it's very difficult to think of Islam without the political aspect, because for Muslims, Islam represents not only the religion, but a way of life in general.
The military-backed government struggles these days to monitor what's being said regarding what it means to be not only a good Muslim, but a good Egyptian in these chaotic political times, which is why Fawzi Mohammed and others who used to visit his small zawiya on Fridays will have to get that guidance somewhere else for now. For The World, I'm Kimberly Adams, Cairo.
Kimberly's story came to us from the public radio program Interfaith Voices and its God and Government series. Maybe you had a wee drop of single malt over Hogmanay. That's New Year's in Scotland. Single malts are whiskies made at single distilleries using only malted barley, and they're celebrated at the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, founded in Edinburgh. Olaf Meyer is an ambassador for the society, but he's not Scottish. He's German.
First time I came to Scotland was 30 years ago. And I know nothing about whiskey at all. I come from the southern part of Germany, so I enjoyed wine and beer. That's my stable diet. So therefore, I came to Scotland, and I had the wonderful experience of staying with a wonderful couple. And the first night, we had a meal. And at the end of the meal, this gentleman said to me, and now we're going to have a dram. I sat in his lounge, and I drank this whiskey. And that was my first whiskey ever in my life. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And this gentleman was a true Scotsman, and he loved Scotland, and he was proud to be Scottish. And he told me now where to go over the next 4 weeks in Scotland, because I was traveling around by bus and by train. And he said to me, Olaf, every night I'm sure you're going to end up in a pub. And he said, and I'm sure you're going to drink beer as a German, but you have to drink Scotch whiskey. He said, because that's the drink of Scotland. But don't drink the stuff, he said, which is hanging on the bar, and people just get it out of there, because that's blended whiskey. He said, don't touch it. You have to drink single malt whiskey. Now, I couldn't say names. I didn't know anything about Highlands, Islands, Speyside, Lowlands. So what I said, I'm going to take the fifth one from the left of the shelf or the second one from the right. I had no idea why they were different. I had no idea how it was made, nothing at all. But I enjoyed the flavors and aromas, and everyone was different.
Vacation over, Olaf Meyer returned to Germany. He put away his backpack and began a career in banking, but he kept on tasting whiskey whenever he could. After a few years, his work took him to London, and then, as luck would have it, on to Edinburgh. Soon, Meyer became a full-time ambassador for the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society. Part of his job is to sample single malts, like this one.
The first thing I've noticed is vanilla flavors, which is very typical for American oak casks. That's where the American whiskies get their flavoring from those new American oak casks, which they have to use fresh. When those American bourbon or Tennessee whiskies get emptied out, these casks are worthless for the American whiskey industry, and they get either shipped down to the Caribbean or they get shipped to Scotland and Scotch whiskey gets matured. And that's what you're smelling. I'm also getting quite a citrusy flavor, sort of even a bit of grassy notes as well. So now I'll take a little sip.
And the whiskey Olaf Meyer is tasting here is at cask strength. That means undiluted by water, i.e. strong.
And I'm quite surprised for a 17-year-old, but that's what we're looking for in the society. We're looking for surprises. The way you can look at it in an individual cask is like every fingerprint is different from every person. So every single cask are going to be different.
Olaf Meyer, ambassador for the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society in Edinburgh. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. The year, 1970, the place Provence, southern France. And Julia Child, of all people, is tired of French cooking.
She wants to do different things. She's ready to do a New England clam chowder. She wants to do an Indian curry. She wants to try different kinds of food other than this French cooking.
What that meant for American cuisine ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Iraq is in the throes of some of the heaviest fighting there in years, and it's happening in a part of Iraq that many American GIs remember all too well, Anbar Province. Iraqi government forces are battling there against jihadist militias linked to al-Qaeda. Over the weekend, the militias even took control of the key city of Fallujah. The news from Iraq has struck a nerve with American veterans. The U.S. military suffered more casualties in Anbar than any other province in the Iraq War. So we put out a call to our network of military vets for their reaction, and The World's Matthew Bell is here to tell us about some of their thoughts. Matthew, what are we hearing from these veterans about Iraq and this new fighting in places like Fallujah?
The news from there is really tough to take for a lot of them, Marco. Fallujah in 2004 was the scene of heavy fighting. The U.S. Marines went in there twice. In December of that year, they lost 80 people. I think the reaction is kind of summed up pretty well by Ryan McNabb. I talked to him from Portland, Oregon.
Well, my initial reaction was physical. I don't know if my gut knotted up or if I got nauseous, but it was frustrating, to say the least.
McNabb served as a medic with the Marine Corps in early 2004. During his seven-month tour, he said that they lost 15 people. I told McNabb that some of the vets contacting us were looking at what's going on in Fallujah now and saying this shows that it just wasn't worth it. There were too many American losses. McNabb told me he understands that some people feel that way.
To a degree, I feel frustration that, yes, people may have died in vain. But, you know, the thing is, that I think almost upsets me more, we're not standing by our word, but I'm proud of how I supported my country.
Matthew, that sense of dishonor of not keeping their word while still supporting the U.S., was that something you found on the minds of other vets?
Yes, there was one Marine that wrote to us and said that he fought in Fallujah, though 10 years ago, for his fellow Marines. And he said, looking at it from the perspective 10 years later is really not fair to sort of judge what they did at that time. Another veteran I spoke with this morning, Marco, Michael Garner from Boise, Idaho. He did two tours in Iraq with the Idaho National Guard. In 2004, he helped train Iraqi soldiers and police that were from Fallujah. And I asked him, tell me a little bit about them.
I don't think any of them were under any illusion. I don't think that they felt like they were joining the winning team, per se, if that makes sense. I don't think they went in with the idea that now that we're trained, we're absolutely going to stomp the crap out of any enemy that comes along. I think that they went in with the resolve of, here we go again. And history, perhaps, has proven them correct.
Did Mike express any concern, Matthew, about his leaving Iraq with U.S. troops and what might happen without having the backs of their Iraqi counterparts?
He said they did their best. They had good days. They had bad days. And on the good days, he said he and his fellow National Guardsmen felt like they were contributing to the place and doing some good in the training activities that they were doing. And then he went on to tell me about one of the really bad days as an example of the frustration.
As we left our base and we're heading home, news came to us that two busloads of police officers, the last graduating class we had, the entire graduating class, two buses were pulled over outside of the base, and every one of them were tied up, shot in the head, and left on the side of the road. And these were good men with families who simply wanted to do right by their communities. I did not understand it. That part, I think, was hard for all of us.
That's got to be very, very tough. And now in Anbar, it's happening again. Sad situation. If you're a returning vet and want to join the community and help inform our coverage, just text RETURN to 69866. Thanks to the vets that reached out to us, and The World's Matthew Bell, thank you too.
Thank you, Marco.
Two decades ago, Jacob Atem was one of the lost boys of Sudan. He was part of that wave of Sudanese war orphans who wandered through East Africa in the 1990s, fleeing the war back home. Atem, like many of his peers, resettled here in the U.S. He worked his way through college and became an American citizen. But when South Sudan achieved independence 2 years ago, Atem and many of the lost boys started to venture back. In recent weeks, they've been swept up again by the violence, this time fighting among political factions within South Sudan. Atem is now safely back in the U.S. He says the new violence is far too reminiscent of his childhood. He vividly recalls what it was like as a child to flee for his life into the bush.
I know what is it like to be a 5 or 6 years old, wandering in the bush with no food, no water. And that bush we used to hide. And then during at the evening, we come out. And when we come out, we didn't have any food. And I remember where we would depend on the leaf of the tree to eat for a month. We happen to drink your own urine. And then after that is you're worried about the lions killing you. my skin is like a skeleton, you can say. Wow. So you can imagine how skinny I was. I could barely walk. And fast forward, I was able to come to the United States when I was 15 as part of the group called Lost Boys of Sudan.
You went back to South Sudan. You felt the need to reinvest in the country, not just lead a comfortable American life.
That's right. I mean, I'm a firm believer, and there was a scripture said, for whom much is given, much is required. So I co-founded an organization called Southern Sudan Healthcare Organization, and to build a health clinic in Mar, in the village that was destroyed during the war and during all these troubles. So I and my other fellow lost boys, Lual Ding and community people, we built this health clinic, and we were able to establish it 2 years ago, where we were actually seeing over 100 patients a day. And every year I took American medical doctors mission working with me.
So you go back to South Sudan. You were there until very recently, and it's kind of like back to the future now. I mean, a few weeks ago, you were again, just like in your boyhood, hiding in the bush as rebels loyal to Riek Machar swept through town, burning huts, shooting.
Yes.
Take us back to that moment last month when, once again, you knew you were in trouble.
So I arrived on December 10th, and I went to Bor with two Americans. We were helping the Ministry of Health training, and then all of a sudden there was a disagreement between the presidential guard. And what happened is there was a general who was loyal to Riek Machar. His name is Peter Gadit. He came and captured Bor, and that time we ran into the bush to the north along the Nile, and we stayed for a couple of days. And when we were there, I didn't know what to do with an American, so we forced ourselves back to the UN compound. Along the way, we could see people being shot. One incident, a couple of people were shot, but they didn't pass away. You can see their hands and their leg dangling. And thank God we made it to the UN compound. We stayed there for a couple of days, and the UN compound was the only safety at that time. And then I reached out for our State Department. I was the first person to report to the State Department that we are being attacked in Bor, and we negotiate how we can could be rescued.
Right, and then a possible rescue. You thought an American aircraft was coming to pick you up. What happened?
Yes, yeah, so we arranged. The State Department told me that tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. there will be a flight coming, and we got all of our American citizens, the lost boy. We were over 30 people. Most of them, the lost boy who came back to rebuild the country. As we were standing in the line, we were about to be escorted to the airport. We saw three American planes coming into the airport, and before we know it, they were fired at so hard by the rebels. That was our plane, and unfortunately, the rebel injured about three or four Americans, and the plane were turned around to go somewhere into a nearest country.
Wow.
And that was devastated, because where can we go now? The UN is actually taking their people. Nobody, we Americans were stranded there. With the grace of God, we tried to actually go and get on the UN flight, another UN. Unfortunately, because I'm Dinka, and if you're Dinka, you're not allowed to fly out. Twice I was denied to go to Juba based on my ethnic background. And finally, I made it out on the World Food Program, because my organization, Southern Sudan Healthcare Organization, we partner with them. And it was only me who made it out to Juba, but I still concerned with my American friends who are left, about 29 of them now. Mm. I'm so glad to be here and thankful, but many of my friends, like Andrew, didn't make it. Andrew is one of the lost boys who went back just like me, but he is in Pariang. He's in Unity State. Unfortunately, he's Dinka. He was killed. One of the lost boys lost his life. And there is more lost boys who are in the bush right now with their families. And they literally come into the plane and look into your eyes and see if you're from Dinka or not.
Let me ask you something. I mean, I'm sorry to sound naive, but can't the Dinka, your ethnic group, and the group of rebel leader Riek Machar, can't they just get along in the name of the new nation? I mean, you must have many newer friends. You just talked about that. I mean,
how do
you experience this deep, really explosive divide between the Dinka and the newer?
We can exist together, and we don't deserve the people of South Sudan to die and to be held, whether you're Nuer or you're Dinka. Now children are in the bush like I was in 1991. The bottom line is we need to coexist together. We just need good governance, freedom of expression. I blame this in the government. They need to get their act together and have something called democracy. When there's no this prejudice idea, you're Dinka, you're Nuer, we are so Sudanese. That's the bottom line. We should not go on the ethnic base.
Jacob Atem was born in the part of Sudan that is now South Sudan. He's now a PhD student at the University of Florida, Gainesville. Jacob, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. God bless.
The World Cup of Soccer. It's a summer event, but FIFA, the sports international body, is rethinking that, at least for the 2022 World Cup. Yeah, it's a long way off, but since it's being hosted by the Gulf Emirate of Qatar, heat is an issue. A biggie. We're talking 107 Fahrenheit average temps in July. So today, a top FIFA official said that the 2022 tournament will not be held in June and July, more like November and December, he said. David Roth is a sports journalist. He visited Qatar recently and wrote a five-part series on SBNation.com about his time there. So you were there in the cooler months for Qatar. I mean, what was it like? Good soccer weather?
Super beautiful soccer weather. It was in the 70s, really sunny, really pleasant. They don't get that many weeks of that during the year. I just happened to be fortunate that I got five consecutive days of it while I was there.
And you also got a pretty good taste of what Qatar is all about as a country. Strangely, you compare it to living in a duty-free store in an airport. Explain that.
The duty-free comparison to me was just this sense of they clearly want to be a brand, not in the sort of the glib way that, you know, Coca-Cola wants to represent feelings of home and, you know, corn syrup you can feel good about. What Qatar seems to want is to be a luxury destination and a country that has a certain sort of image about it. They just have a vast amount of money and a vast amount of will. They also, I think, seem to understand that the way that they've been going about getting this set up and this huge and very now public mistreatment of labor by the subcontractors that they have building the infrastructure.
Right, because a lot of the labor is provided by immigrant workers.
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of the country are foreigners, and there's this very small core of Qatari people. They represent about between 10 and 15% of the people that are actually in the country. And I think they understand now that just because it won't play, you know, in the public, and then also because of the fact that it's wrong, that they're going to have to do things a little bit different. But the emir is the one whose opinion matters. If he wants to have a thing happen, there's the money there to make it happen.
David, you also found Qatar to be one of the least walkable places in the world.
Supremely unwalkable. Although, again, that will probably change. I mean, but it's weird to have this sort of metaphor of emerging city that's really more sort of like an erupting city. I mean, things change from you turn a corner and there's a crane there that wasn't there before, building a building that wasn't there before. That's like actually literally a thing that happened. I got really lost because I couldn't identify a construction crane that was suddenly in the middle of the sidewalk. And it was because it had been there, you know, moved there 15 minutes earlier.
So if Qatar completes the sidewalks and FIFA changes the calendar to deal with the heat, what are the big issues remaining with holding the World Cup in Qatar in 2022?
One of the issues would be that in Qatar, it's very difficult to get alcohol, and alcohol is a very important part of the experience of being at soccer games for a lot of people. So they are going to have to find a workaround on that. I just believe that if, you know, with the exception maybe of creating stadia that you can play soccer in when it's 105 degrees, I feel like there could very well be, you know, a tent where you can get a beer and it'll be there for however long the World Cup is. And then when the World Cup's over, that tent will never be seen again. But like, I do believe that that's possible. But they have to tackle bigger issues first. They have to build 9 stadiums and expand 3 others. So I guess they'll work the beer thing out when they get to it.
And is it true that some of those stadiums were actually thought maybe we can air condition them?
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea with all of them, I think. They did a 35-minute video presentation that all the FIFA, the executive committee that was there to review the bid. I saw that video, and one of the things that they promise is, and this is a quote, that they will harness the power of our friend, the sun. And that's the end of the quote, too. And they will use their friend, the sun, to create a solar-powered air conditioning system that, again, they promised would change the world, which, you know, it certainly would if it existed, which it does not. And right now they have the capacity to air condition one of the stadiums, the field and the seats. And it works. It makes the conditions playable on the field. But it's not solar powered. It's generator powered, which is a huge energy suck. I mean, there's a reason why you don't run the air conditioning in a convertible with the top down. And it seems to be that that's more or less what they're going to have to try to figure out. How do you air condition a motorcycle?
David Roth, who wrote a five-part series for SB Nation on Qatar and their preparations for the 2022 World Cup. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. In 1970, several American culinary icons got together in southern France. Among them, Julia Child, MFK Fisher, and James Beard. Luc Barr says that time in Provence shaped the way we eat now. Barr is Fisher's grandnephew and the author of Provence 1970.
It wasn't really a planned trip. Julia Child had just finished the second volume of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and it was a huge bestseller, and they had launched the book that November, and then she and her husband, Paul Child, said, let's go on vacation to our house in Provence. And they said to everyone they knew, you know, come with us. Meanwhile, my great aunt, MFK Fisher, had a long planned trip to France with my grandmother already set for that fall. And so they said, yeah, we'll stop by too. James Beard, coincidentally, was signed up in this diet clinic nearby in Grasse. So it was really a coincidence that they all found themselves there in the sort of late fall, winter of 1970, together.
Now, the conceit, if I can put it that way, of your book is that this moment in Provence in December of 1970 was important for American cooking. So describe the food scene at that moment in the U.S. and what you believe happened.
I just want to back up quickly to, you know, the fact that all of these people had discovered food and cooking in Europe. They were Americans who had had this kind of epiphany about food when they first came to France and discovering, wow, you know, bread with a delicious crust or amazing French butter and just food that they could not find at home in America. And they brought that back and taught Americans how to cook, especially Julia Child. I mean, her show starting in 1962 had a huge impact on American cooking. Fast forward now to 1970, they're no longer so interested in French food. You know, for the longest time, good cooking was French cooking, and a great restaurant was a French restaurant. And now in 1970, that's starting to change. You know, people are talking about Indian food. People are wanting to cook Chinese food. So there's a new interest in a broader view of cooking.
There's a crucial moment in the book, in a chapter you call The Twilight of the Snobs, in which MFK Fisher has dinner with the foodie and cookbook author Richard Olney. So remind us who Olney was in the food scene and what happens at that dinner.
I had never heard of Olney before I started working on this book, and he's not super well known, but he's a very influential and a fascinating guy. He wrote wonderful cookbooks, and he was a terrific snob and a sort of a misanthrope and the kind of person who was willing to say sometimes bitter and cruel things about other people. He was a bohemian, a new kind of cook who wanted to cook seasonal recipes and was not interested in the classic French super fancy way of cooking. So Olney comes to visit and he stops in and he sees Beard at the diet clinic and he visits with the Childs. And then there's a potluck dinner where he comes to dinner with MFK Fisher, my great aunt, and her two friends, Sybil Bedford and Ida Lord. It's the crisis point of my book because at the end of that dinner, he and Sybil Bedford end up sort of drinking into the night and recounting all of their bitter resentments about everyone else. And at this point also is when MFK Fisher has sort of had enough and decides to leave and go off on her own.
Just take us into that little sidebar about why she kind of leaves that scene, because things do seem to shift for your great aunt in that moment.
MF had long thought that she was going to spend the rest of her life in France. In some deep way, she always thought that in the end, she would end up dying on a hillside in Provence. And now coming to the realization that, you know what, she's had enough of this kind of continental snobbery and this superiority that seems so deeply connected to a certain kind of attachment to France, which Olney represents. So Olney and Sybil Bedford, who go on and on about what is a great wine, and of course French wine is so much better than California wines could ever be, and so on and so forth, and she's had enough of that. So she decides to leave. This is a week before Christmas, and she goes off on her own to Arles. She checks in at a hotel, and she wanders around Arl looking for a restaurant to eat at, and then she goes back to the hotel every day and she writes in her diary, and it's sort of stream of consciousness, thinking about France and herself and her life and what it all means. And I found this diary, which gave me a kind of view into her psychology at that moment.
What was that like for you? I mean, with the diary, with some of these letters, which included love letters and a journal of your great aunts. I mean, what did you learn about M.F.K. Fisher through the process of researching this book that you didn't know before?
I learned a lot, actually. I mean, it's funny. I grew up knowing her and visiting her as a kid. I grew up in California in the 1970s, and so when I was 9, 10 years old, we would stop by all the time and see her up in Sonoma County. But I didn't know her in this kind of intimate way. I was very fortunate that my great aunt was having this love affair with Arnold Gingrich. Gingrich was the founding editor of Esquire magazine. He was married, unhappily, and they had this kind of sort of romantic relationship that really what it amounted to was a lot of letters. In fact, they wrote each other letters every single day. Mm-hmm. And when I was working on the book, then I found MF's letters back and forth with her daily letters saying what she was doing while she and James Beard were going to go down to the Picasso Museum or whatever it was, the sort of the daily schedule and what they were eating and talking about. And like I said, full of gossip and, oh, who's going to be the new, you know, restaurant critic at the time since Craig Claiborne is leaving, and all this kind of stuff is in these letters. And again, I was very fortunate to find that stash of letters. The letters and the diaries did give me an intimate view into not just MF, but all of these characters, actually.
So, Luke, back to these foodies and food snobs in Provence in 1970. What do you think this tension of all these different characters and personalities actually led to? I mean, what do you think about that moment struck you as pivotal to today's American palate?
Let's start with Julia Child. Julia Child, she wants to do different things. She's ready to do a New England clam chowder. She wants to try different kinds of food other than this French cooking. So she's ready to move on. Meanwhile, MF is also deciding to leave France behind and write less nostalgically and less sentimentally about France. And in terms of food, you know, I think Olney, in a way, shows us the perhaps most vividly the way forward. And he, like, he
has, yeah, you said he was kind of the hero in your book.
I think he is, in a way. Olney is the mentor for Alice Waters and that whole strand of a more bohemian kind of cooking. It's interesting to think about, you know, in the 60s, great restaurants were French restaurants, and great chefs, they went to cooking school and then they trained with other chefs and they worked in the kitchen and they were apprentices, and there was a whole system for how you became a restaurateur. Now, Alice Waters comes along in the late 60s, early 70s, and she launches Chez Panisse. She's never trained in a kitchen. She didn't go to school. It's a, like I said, it's a kind of more bohemian way of cooking. And then she's got the garden and she's bringing in the seasonal vegetables and all that. You know, that's all in the air at this moment.
Luke Barr, author of the book Provence 1970. Great bunch of stories, Luke. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's a tune by the band Massilia Sound System. They're from Marseille, not too far from Provence. It's about camaraderie and eating. It's called Street Dinner. That'll do it for me, Marco Werman, the rest of our team from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Bon appétit until tomorrow. Vraiment, ils veulent arriver à ce point. Et c'est assez difficile, mais après... The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.